know about you, but I personally like rainy days. And I know that, I think that probably puts me in the minority, but I guess that goes back to the days on the farm when it was raining, that meant that you got to stay inside and you didn't have to go out in the field. On the other hand, how many of you are school teachers or have been school teachers? Let me see your hands. Yeah, we got a bunch. School teachers generally don't like rainy days. My mother-in-law and father-in-law were both teachers. My father-in-law was the principal. And I remember that my mother-in-law used to have a word for rainy days. She called them wolfish days. Now, I don't have a clue in the world. I don't think she did where that word came from. I don't even think that's a word. But nobody in her family ever questioned exactly what that meant. They just knew that it was not a good day. She despised rainy days because it meant that the kids had to stay inside all day long. They couldn't go out to recess or dinner or whatever. So she didn't like rainy days. Maybe she was kind of like the teacher who was helping one of her pupils put on his boots on a rainy day like this, and he asked for help, and she could see why he needed help. Even with her pulling and pushing, the little boots just didn't want to go on, and by the time that she got them on, she had worked up a sweat. And she almost cried when the little boy said, "Teacher, they're on the wrong feet." And she looked, and sure enough, they were. And so it wasn't much easier pulling them off than it was putting them on, but she managed to keep her cool as they both worked together, and they got the boots off, and this time they switched them and got the boots on the right feet. And just about the time that she finished, he announced, "These aren't my boots." And she bit her tongue, and she took a deep breath, and she wanted to say a lot of things, but she just kind of mumbled under her breath, and again she struggled to help him pull the boots off, and she finally got them off, and no sooner had they gotten them off than he said, "These are my brother's boots. My mom made me wear them." And now she didn't know whether to laugh or cry, but she mustered up what grace she had left, and she wrestled the boots on his feet again, and helping him get into his coat, she said, "Well, where are your mittens?" He said, "I stuffed them in the toe of my boots." We're in a series of lessons on how to use your money. Jesus consistently taught about the pitfalls and the dangers and the temptations and the consequences of having money and desiring to have money. In Matthew chapter 16, Jesus' popularity begins to wane as he teaches things that people don't want to hear. He knows that people will only accept generally his teachings that either fit into our comfortable lifestyle and reinforce it, or will give us a better life here presently. Jesus told a number of stories that contain warnings about the problems associated with riches. He told the story of the rich fool. He told the story of the rich man and Lazarus. And then there was not a story, but an incident of the rich young ruler who came to Jesus. And in spite of these and many other warnings about riches, the vast majority of people in the world still believe, as Solomon quoted in Ecclesiastes 10:19, money is the answer for everything. And that's pretty much a mantra that people have in our world, and not just our world, everybody believes, in spite of the warnings that Jesus gives, every one of us believes, well, you know, I know those kind of things happen, but I can handle it. But the truth is, not very many of us can handle riches. And maybe that's why I'm not rich. In Charleston, West Virginia, on December the 14th, 2004, some of you will recall this story. The wife of the lottery winner who won on Christmas Day 2002 the richest undivided jackpot in U.S. history says that she regrets his purchase of the $314.9 million ticket that thrust her family into the public spotlight. Jack Whitaker took his winnings in a lump sum of $113 million after taxes. And his wife said, 2 years later, I wish all of this never would have happened. I wish I had torn the ticket up. She said, since winning the lottery, her husband has been arrested twice for drunken driving and been ordered into rehab. He pleaded no contest to a misdemeanor assault charge for attacking a bar manager. He's accused in two lawsuits of making trouble involving women at a nightclub and a racetrack, for which he was given 2-year probation. There have been several thefts involving Whitaker's vehicle, his office, and his house. One of the thefts occurred at his home in September prior to the writing of this article, on the same day that an 18-year-old friend of Whitaker's granddaughter was found dead in his home. The death remains under investigation. On December the 9th, 2004, 5 days prior to the writing of this article, Whitaker, 57, reported his granddaughter missing. And this was the occasion on which this newspaper wrote this article. Having reported his granddaughter missing, her body was later found wrapped in a tarp under a junk van outside her boyfriend's home. Some of you will remember that. Evidently from a drug overdose. Her funeral was on Christmas Eve, 2004, just a short 2 years after he had won this amount of money. Is money the answer to everything? Is the accumulation of wealth in this world what the Lord wants for us as Christians? And all together now we can say, it wouldn't happen to me. Right? We know for a fact it wouldn't happen to me if I won that, if I had that much money. But money is deceitful. That's what Jesus said in the parable of the sower in Matthew chapter 13, verse 22. The deceitfulness of riches will choke the spiritual life out of a person. You believe that? The deceitfulness of riches will choke the spiritual life out of a person. The word deceitful means that which gives a false impression. And money definitely projects a certain impression, doesn't it? And money holds out to you certain promises, doesn't it? The problem is it can't deliver on those promises. As we saw in our last lesson, that's why Jesus used the Aramaic word mammon, that in which someone puts his trust. It doesn't necessarily mean money. It is most often used as money, but it means anything in which people put their trust. And he added the word unrighteous to it, unrighteous mammon, denoting that the desire for it, the love of it, the trusting in it, the misuse of it is a source of most of the evil in this world. When you stop and think about what's the source of all the pain and heartache in this world, some major portion of it is because of the pursuit of money and the love of money, the desire for money. And it's not just the having of it. It's the desire to have it that leads people into all kinds of ruin. And they're pierced through, James will say, with many darts. But it doesn't have to cause us to lose our soul if we will listen carefully to Jesus' warnings and instructions regarding the proper attitude of how we're to use our money, of money's purpose and its use. Now here's a question for you and for me. Do we really believe that we need help in being taught how to manage our money? How many people do you think would say, yes, I need help? Well, the people who've gotten in financial trouble will say that. But how about before we get in financial trouble? How about when we have lots of money? How about when things are going well? Do we want somebody coming and telling us how to manage our money? Well, if they can tell us how to accumulate more, maybe yes. Let's move to the parable. We're in Luke chapter 16. I'd like for you to turn there. Luke 16. And let me outline the parable for you. We'll be following this outline in the next few lessons, because this is the parable that brings lots of questions. We read it, we end up with more questions than we have answers, and we move on generally. Probably the most mysterious of all the parables that Jesus told. Sometimes maybe the most disturbing to us. Verse 1 through the first part of verse 8 is the story. Jesus tells the story of the unjust steward. Jesus told his disciples there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and he asked him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management because you cannot be manager any longer." The manager said to himself, "What shall I do now? My master's taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses." So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, "How much do you owe my master?" 800 gallons of olive oil," he replied. The manager told him, "Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. Then he asked the second, "And how much do you owe?" 1,000 bushels of wheat," he replied. He told him, "Take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. And so there's the story that Jesus told. And now, beginning in the last half of verse 8, he makes an application of the story. He says, "For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it's gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings." And now verse 10 through 13 is going to give us two principles that Jesus wants us to know regarding stewardship. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you've not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you've not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. And now in verse 14 and 15, he responds to the Pharisees' derision of his story. The Pharisees, who loved money, heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. And he said to them, "You're the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of men, but God knows your hearts. What is highly valued among men is detestable in God's sight." The story of the unjust steward. It's mysterious, isn't it? In fact, there are some things about it that really bother us. If we really were pressed, we might even say, "I wish Jesus hadn't told this story," because it really leaves some things up in the air, some questions about the commending this unjust steward that really bother us. The steward, first of all, I want in this lesson, we're going to be kind of... In the first lesson, I said, I don't want us to just clear up the things that bother us in this. I want us to learn the teachings. Well, in this particular lesson, I want to clear up some of the mysteries involved, some of the difficulties involved in this parable to help us understand it and lay the background so that we or lay those things aside so that we can spend our time understanding the truths that he wants us to gain from this story. First of all, he talked about a wasteful steward in verse 1 and 2. And remember, a steward is someone who's entrusted with managing the affairs or the goods of another. And so the first message in all of this is, the things that we have at our disposal, whether it's money, time, energy, talents, family, cars, houses, goods, whatever it may be, they don't belong to us. That's the first thing we must understand in order to be able to handle worldly wealth the way that God wants us to. It doesn't belong to us. It's God's. We're just stewards. We're just managers. Now, let me ask you this question. What caused this man to lose his job? Was it his dishonesty? No. Let's stay with this story now. Don't let me lose you here. He wasn't necessarily dishonest. At least not the problem with why he was called into account and why he lost his job. Jesus telling the story says he was wasting his master's goods. Interestingly, that's the same word that was used. You remember when we studied the story about the prodigal? It's the same word that was used in chapter 15, just a chapter before this. In that story, verse 13, it said the prodigal son was squandering his money in a foreign country. He was spending it wastefully. He was scattering it out without any real thought about it. That's the problem that this steward had. He was taking his master's money and he was squandering it. And so the master came to him and he said, bring the books. You've lost your job. You're not using the money that I entrusted to you wisely. And so he's going to remove him. But he didn't immediately say, okay, hand me the keys and walk you out to your car. He said, bring me the books. I know that you've been wasting my money. You've not been using it as a wise steward, and so bring me the books. And now we have a wasteful steward. Now we have a shrewd steward in verses 3 through the first part of verse 8. He assesses the situation in verse 3. He says, I'm losing my job. I've had a desk job for so long that I'm unable to do manual labor. It happens. I surely don't want to haul hay all day anymore, I can tell you that. And then he said, I'm ashamed to beg. And so he's in a bind. He's had a good job, good desk job. But now he says, I'm not able to do manual labor anymore. I'm ashamed to beg, so what am I going to do? So in verse 4 through the first part of verse 8, he cooks up a plan. And in cooking the plan, what he does is he cooks the books, doesn't he? Question. Now, let's get down to the thing that bothers us the most. What was his concern? He expressed a concern as he is cooking the books. His concern is about his future, right? Next question. What was the purpose of his plan? What did he want to accomplish with his plan? He says, I need to do something so that when I've lost my job, what? I'll have a secure future. People will invite me into their home because I've done them favors. Right? And so the purpose of his plan, and this is a key, the purpose of his plan was to secure his future. Now, in order to do that, what did he do? Well, he cheated his master, didn't he? Now, he was no longer thinking about the moment. Up to this time, he wasn't concerned about his future. He had plenty of stuff at his disposal, and so he was just spending money however he wanted to. Just how whatever struck him as he wanted to do, he did it. But now the situation has changed and he's now thinking about his future. And he used what was at his disposal to secure his future. Hang on to it. We're working it down. And his master's response in the first part of verse 8 is what makes this parable so puzzling, right? The response is not what we would expect. It says the master praised or commended the steward. And we have to ask, why? Why would he praise this guy who had been wasting his money and now he cooked the books and he cheated him? Well, the first thing we need to note is he did not praise or commend him for his dishonesty. In verse 8, he talked about it being dishonest, and in verse 10, he condemned the dishonesty. All right, we've got to get all these in place. And the word dishonest means that which is not in accord with what is right. But rather, he praised him because he had acted shrewdly, the NIV says. The King James Version says he had acted wisely. The same word is used in Matthew chapter 7, verse 24 through 26, and I want you to get this. This word, he acted shrewdly, or he acted wisely. The same word is used in Matthew chapter 7 when it refers to a wise man who built his house on a rock. Why was this builder wise or shrewd? This builder who built his house on a rock rather than on the sand. Because when he built his house, he was planning for his future security. He was looking ahead. He didn't simply build it to look good for the moment. He didn't go out on the beach like we have so many people here in America doing and building a house on the sand, and then here comes some wind and some waves and everybody's got to pay for their house because the house is gone. He built his house on the rock and he was commended as a wise man. It's the same word. He was shrewd. He was wise. And this word means practically wise. We would might even say common sense. But he was wise in a practical way. He was prudent. Now, punchline. That's how God wants us to use the money that he has entrusted us in view of our future. Not just our future here on this earth, but in view of our future in eternity. And that's why he calls this man shrewd and why he commended him for his shrewdness. Because he used what he had at his disposal to ensure for himself, or at least to contribute toward a secure future. That's what he commended him for, not for the dishonesty there. And it doesn't say that the master gave him his job back when he commended him. It doesn't say that he approved of his dishonesty. It says that when the master discovered what this servant had done, he said, "You are one smart dude." Now, one more thing is really important. Have you assumed in this story that the master or the rich man was God? Have you assumed that? I have to tell you, all these years I have. He didn't say that. Jesus is telling the story, and we have to let him interpret what the story means. We can't impose our own meaning. He didn't say that the rich man was God. He just told the story that there was a certain rich man who had a steward, and he didn't say the rich man was God. You see, part of our problem is we've assumed that the rich man was God, and that it was God who was commending this steward. He just told a practical story, and he drew a conclusion from it. And now the story is over, and Jesus is going to make the application to the parable, and we need to let him make his application in verse 8 through 9. But before he makes his application, he's going to make some comments regarding shrewdness in the last part of verse 8. And I might add that this is a self-evident truth that he brings out. The sons of this age are wiser in dealing with people like themselves than are the sons of light. Just a comment. Now, let's talk about that a minute. In fact, this is the last difficulty we're going to address. We're going to set these aside so that we can see what this story does say. Regarding the affairs of this world, the sons of this age are wiser in dealing with people like themselves than are the sons of light. Right. Regarding the affairs of this world, you're outmanned and outgunned as a Christian. The world doesn't have the same scruples that a Christian does. And don't allow yourself to stoop to the level of the world, even if it means that you'll come up short. The steward was willing to betray his master's confidence. He had squandered his master's goods, and he was willing to cheat his master in order to get ahead. These things are not in a Christian's playbook. Paul wrote to the Christians at Corinth who were resorting to some of these same tactics that the world does in business. And he said, the very fact that you have lawsuits among you means that you have been completely defeated already. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be cheated? Instead, you yourselves cheat and you do wrong and you do this to your brothers. And then he ends by saying, don't you know that the wicked will not inherit the kingdom of God? Who's the wicked here in this context? The person who's so bent on getting ahead that he's willing to sue his brother because he feels like that he's been cheated. He said, why not be wronged? Christian businessman, you're constantly being called on, maybe even pressured, to make ethical decisions about what you're willing to do to make money, maybe for your company. Be honest and be faithful, even when it costs you money. Regardless of what the cost is, look ahead to the future. And by that, I mean your eternal future when you make these decisions. I know there's a temptation to say when somebody gets to you, well, two can play that game. Don't do it. That's the devil's playbook. You see, it's not that you can't play that game. It's not that you're not smart enough to play that game. It's that you won't go there. It's that that's off limits to you. And because it is, there are times that you're going to get taken advantage of. And people with different scruples, with a different playbook than you have, are going to get to you. That's the price you pay for being a Christian. You don't resort to the same tactics that they do. Remember, the wicked will not inherit the kingdom of God. And so when you look at that, when you're evaluating that, consider your future. Not just this deal. Not just whether or not you got cheated. Not just whether or not you can make some money in this situation. But look to your real future and make your decision based on that. We need to make sure that our goals and our priorities are aligned with God's will for our life. You see, succeeding in business and making lots of money is not the ultimate objective in a Christian's life. Being faithful, being a faithful steward is our objective in life. And that makes us different. And in some ways, it makes us vulnerable. And if your pride can't stand being vulnerable, you're going to have some problems. You're going to have some problems when you face the Lord. Because one day He's going to call you in and say, bring the books. Let's look at the books. Let's see how you dealt in your life with money. God is concerned about our goals and our ambitions and our motivations in life. And He gives three goals of a Christian regarding our use of money. Make it your ambition to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business and to work with your own hands, just as we told you, so that, number one, here's your purpose for working. Number one, so that your daily life may win the respect of outsiders. And number two, so that you will not be dependent on anybody. 1 Thessalonians 5, 11 and 12. And then Ephesians 4, 28 says, number three, so that you may have something to share with those in need. There's your priorities, Christians. Why do you work? Why do you have a business? What do you do with your money? What's the goal? What's the purpose of it? So that you use it in such a way that you can win the respect of outsiders. A person who is honest in his dealings with money is noted. And people respect that. Number two, you'll not be dependent on anybody. You don't have to go to other people constantly and live off of them and their hard work. And number three, that you may have something to share with those in need. You see, the point of all this is that the love of money is the source of much of the pain and heartache and failure in this world. But money can be a blessing when it's used as a tool to help secure your eternal future. And in so doing, you help secure the future of all of those whom you influence. If you, the steward, will listen and follow the instructions of your master about money. Boy, it's deceitful. It's deceitful. It makes some claims that it cannot follow through with. And the whole world is out to get it, because money solves all the problems in the world, doesn't it? Boy, if that's what we build our lives around, then one of these days, we may die with a big pile of money and lots of money in the bank. So what? Is that going to help you when you face the Lord? Not one iota. In fact, it could be the cause of your demise. And so this morning, if there's something in your life that you know is amiss in your attitude toward business and God and how you handle money and the things that God has entrusted to you, and you don't want God to call you in tonight and say, let's look at the books. If there's something that you would like to change before you face God, this is your time. While we stand.
There's a fire.